You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream flavors. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. By most accounts, there was no reason why San Antonio Mayor and Obama cabinet member Julian Castro would have been expected to be a success in life. Born to unmarried parents in a poverty-stricken neighborhood of a struggling city, his prospects of escaping his circumstance seemed bleak. But he and his twin brother Joaquin had something going for them. Their mother. A former political activist, she provided the launch pad for what would become an astonishing ascent. Julian and Joaquin would go on to attend Stanford and Harvard before entering politics at the ripe age of 26. Soon after, Joaquin became a state representative and Julian was elected mayor of San Antonio, a city he helped revitalize and transform into one of the country's leading economies. His success in Texas propelled him onto the national stage, where he was the keynote speaker at the 2012 DNC, the same spot President Obama held 3 conventions prior, and then to Washington, D.C., where he served as the Obama administration's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. After being shortlisted as a potential running mate for Hillary Clinton, he's now seen by many as a future presidential candidate himself. Not only is he spending a fair amount of time in the early primary states these days, but he's also published a new memoir titled An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. And today, Julian Castro joins me on the podcast to tell the remarkable story of how his grandmother fled the violence of the Mexican Civil War for America and share some of the values that his political activist mother instilled in he and his twin brother Joaquin. He reveals why he and his brother were so keen to graduate high school a year early, how they tied each other in their very first election for Stanford University's Student Senate, and how a young Julian Castro ran for San Antonio City Council and won while he was still a law student at Harvard. He talks about his initiatives to promote citizen engagement and pre-K education as mayor of San Antonio, why he first turned down a cabinet appointment in the Obama administration, only to later become President Obama's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and what he calls the weird experience of being vetted to be Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016. Plus, he talks seriously about running for the top spot in 2020 and lays out his playbook for beating Donald Trump. Coming up with Julian Castro in just a moment. Julian Castro is a rising star in the Democratic Party who served as the 16th U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Barack Obama, Before that, he served as the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, and as the city councilman for the 7th District. He was selected as the keynote speaker at the 2012 Democratic Convention. In 2016, he made Hillary Clinton's shortlist for VP. And who knows, he might be taking a stab at something bigger pretty soon. He's also written a new memoir titled An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. Julian Castro, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, I enjoyed reading the book, and you spend about half of it talking about your early life. In fact, you open by recounting your grandmother's journey to this country. She has this quintessential American immigrant story. Tell us a little about her.
I grew up with my mother and my grandmother after my parents split up when my brother Joaquin and I were 8. And my grandmother, Victoria, had come to the United States in 1922 as a 7-year-old orphan along with her younger sister. Their parents had passed away and their nearest relatives lived in San Antonio. And so they were brought across through Eagle Pass, Texas, a border town, and ended up on the west side of San Antonio. And, she'd lost her parents. And a few years later, she actually lost also the woman who was there in the household, one of the relatives that brought her in. She was pulled out of school before she had finished elementary school. So she had a very, very difficult early life in the United States. And she never got a formal education, so she worked as a maid, a cook, and a babysitter. And she ended up raising my mother as a single parent. And then my mother was able to graduate from high school and then go on to college and work hard so that my brother and I could have the opportunity that we've had. So it really is this story about struggle and challenges and one generation handing the baton to the next generation. My grandmother, she never owned a house, never owned a car. She never even had a bank account. But she was able to see her daughter graduate from college and, become more successful, and then see her grandchildren get into Stanford University and go to college. And so in many ways, she lived her own American dream, and in some ways she didn't, but she was able to hand off to my mother and then to us all of the fruits of her labor.
If I have this right, I believe that she, and also I think your father, came to America because they were escaping the violence from the Mexican Civil War. Is that right?
My father's family got here a little bit earlier.
Okay.
They got here around 1900. But that's true with respect to my grandmother. My grandmother came in 1922, and most folks, say the Mexican Revolution lasted from about 1910 to 1920. So it was just in that time frame right after that. Mm-hmm. But certainly there were waves of immigrants from Mexico into Texas and other states during that time who were fleeing the violence of the Mexican Revolution.
Do you think about them when you see the Trump administration trying to deny entry to refugees from Syria and immigrants trying to escape violence in Central America these days?
I absolutely do. I also think about the children that have been separated from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think about that audio tape from a couple of months ago of the little girl crying out for her parents. And in a different context, I can understand the pain, because my grandmother was taken for different reasons, because her mother was very ill and was about to pass away. And even in her 70s, later in life, as our grandmother, there would be times when she would absolutely break down crying about her mother and how she never really got to say goodbye and never saw her again.
Yeah.
So I can just imagine for these children, what the feeling is like.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about this title, because it is An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. That seems to imply that maybe the American dream has changed or it's not the same for everyone. What were you trying to say with that?
What I was trying to say is that in my family, and I bet this is true for a lot of families, each generation has realized that, it wasn't enough to just work hard to reach the American dream. we also needed to see progress in our country and needed to fight for that progress.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandmother, you know, my grandmother came, as I said, in 1922, and she came to Texas where you could still find on storefront windows these signs that said, no Negroes, no Mexicans or dogs allowed.
Wow.
And her ability to get an education, to move up, to reach her American dream were very limited. And she realized that. But her way of working through that was to work as hard as she could and make sure that my mother could get a good education. She got a good education. She went to Catholic school for 12 straight years and then a Catholic university. But my mother was really the one that turned that outward and in college became very active politically. She joined the Young Democrats. And then she became involved in the old Chicano movement, the Mexican-American civil rights movement of the late 1960s and early 70s.
Yeah.
Ran for city council when she was 23 years old and lost. But she realized that you know, we needed to make progress in our country so that people of different backgrounds could reach their American dream. And then for Joaquin and for me, my brother and for me, public service has been our way of making sure that other people could have the same kind of wonderful opportunity that we've had in life. And, you know, we're trying to be a part, like a lot of folks in public service are, of making our country better and of expanding opportunity in the 21st century.
Clearly, she's the one who instilled those ideals in you. What kind of things would she tell you boys about civic obligation and political engagement when you were young?
Well, you know, she encouraged us to participate and to pay attention. She used to take us to different speeches and rallies and, you know, have us hand out leaflets on election day. And I can remember when I was 9 or 10 years old, sitting in some 3-hour or 4-hour long meeting where the adults were talking about organizing a rally or something. And, you know, that was my mom. My mom was just very dead set on us being good citizens and on participating. She didn't encourage us or never said, you know, you have to go into politics. People often ask us about that. She never encouraged us to actually run for office, but she did encourage us to participate.
Yeah, and you both did go into politics. I didn't mention this earlier, but of course, your brother Joaquin is also a U.S. congressman. And also, you two are twins. I don't think I mentioned that. Back in those days, was there much of a sibling rivalry between the two of you?
Yeah, we're twins. Joaquin likes to go around saying that I'm a minute uglier than he is, but I'm actually a minute older. And we absolutely were competitive. In fact, some of the most fun parts to write of the book, An Unlikely Journey, were about the competition between us. We used to compete in sports and grades and just basically for those folks who are out there who are twins themselves or who have siblings that are or parents of twins, you know that you're often thought of as a package deal. And people treat you the same way. And because of that, you got to try and distinguish yourself. And it's natural that you're going to compete. And we did a lot of that. We also, we had different football teams that we liked. You know, my brother took the Dallas Cowboys, which is basically the Texas team, very early on. And so I had to take another one. I chose the Eagles. And on the Sundays where the Eagles and the Cowboys would play, you didn't want to be in that household because it got pretty bad. But one of the really wonderful things about growing up is just like a lot of people have a different relationship with their parents. You know, let's say when you're 35 than when you did when you're 15 and rebelling against them. Joaquin and I, you know, our relationship developed from this relationship of course, always loving each other and being very close, but competing all the time. To collaborating all the time now.
Yeah, it's interesting because you were very competitive with each other, but you were also, at least for much of your lives, pretty much tied at the hip through high school, college, law school. In fact, you and your brother apparently set out to graduate high school a year early and succeeded at that. What was your hurry?
I think we were just in a hurry, you know. We figured if we could get that thing done in 3 years, high school done in 3 years instead of four, that we'll try that. I don't know. For me, you know, I enjoyed my high school. I liked high school, but it was not, you know, a lot of people say high school are the best years of your life. I didn't feel that way, you know. I mean, I was looking forward to the future, and when it came time to make a decision about where to go to school, we applied to a lot of the same schools, but ultimately we decided both to go to Stanford. And I really couldn't have imagined going to college at a different place from my brother at the age of 18.
Really?
So we decided to stay together, and I think that made a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you say that you and Joaquin both got into Stanford because of affirmative action. Do you feel like that gave you added pressure to prove yourself once you got in?
No, not really. You know, it's been interesting, and I know there's a case, I think, that's being litigated right now around Harvard. I think that with regard to affirmative action, that it has served a real purpose of helping to diversify certain colleges and universities with folks who are very well qualified. And my experience was that it wasn't necessarily somebody's SAT score that dictated how well they were going to do there. It was really how hard are you willing to work? How much are you dedicated to the effort? And the other thing that I realized along the way is that you know, I believe that there's a place for consideration of somebody's racial or ethnic background. Yeah, I also think that there are different ways that people encounter challenges in life. You know, I think about folks who have a disability, for instance, or folks who come from very, very humble economic backgrounds. And so, you know, the process that admissions offices go through of considering the whole person and what they can add to the student body, to me, makes a lot of sense. You know, they're not setting quotas. They're trying to make sure that they have a student body that each student there can benefit from being a part of.
Mm-hmm. So once you were both at Stanford, you didn't feel any kind of a backlash from students or any kind of jealousies or anything like that?
No, not at Stanford.
Yeah.
In fact, at Stanford, I felt like, you know, people kind of accepted if you were there that you were smart and wanted to work hard and so forth. What I did see at Stanford, when I write about in the book, is I could see the inequality that exists in schools across the United States. And I write about a moment where we were, I think, in a dining hall and talking about the number of AP classes that folks had taken. You know, folks will remember advanced placement classes.
Right.
And there was some guy that had taken like 12 AP classes and gotten the credits. And my school altogether, I think, offered like two or three. And so you could just tell at a small level the differences and what those differences can mean for students. I could really see that at Stanford because you had people there from every single state and I want to say 37 different countries at the time I was there.
So you think that at this point there are still some high schools and junior high schools that operate on sort of a separate but equal type of system, huh? Not equal, sorry. Separate but not equal. But,
yeah, not equal. There's no question in my mind, both from my personal experience, I grew up and went to the public schools my whole life, to I write about in the book, going back in between college and law school, and for one semester, I was a permanent substitute teacher at my old high school, and I got a different perspective at that point on the students that I was trying to teach. And then as a mayor of San Antonio, dedicating a lot of my time to try and improve the educational achievement of the city, of course, there's still a tremendous amount of inequality out there. And, you know, the good news is there are some policymakers out there in our country that are trying with all of their effort to fix that and trying to dedicate both the ingenuity and the resources that are necessary. But there are also a lot of headwinds out there. You know, I would put the U.S. Congress and the president, as well as a lot of state legislatures, in that boat.
Yeah. There's a great story about, I guess, when you and your brother were at Stanford, you both ran for the Student Senate and somehow actually tied for that office and ended up sharing it, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, we were both able to, we ran for the ASSU, which is the Student Senate of Stanford. Yeah. It was our first election. We'd never run for anything before. And they had these weird rules. You know, you could only campaign for 1 week. There was a $90 campaign spending limit, and people could vote online. There were 43 candidates running for Student Senate, and the top 10 candidates would get a voting slot in the Senate. So, you know, there was more than one place that was available, fortunately. And Joaquin and I campaigned together. We figured out that the best way to put the best place to put our flyers, campaign flyers, was on the back of bathroom stalls. Because you had a captive audience.
That's brilliant.
People couldn't avoid your flyer. Yeah. So we just, you know, littered the bathroom stalls with our campaign posters. And on election night, they announced that we had tied with 811 votes. And so we were both in first place, which is kind of odd because I found out later that there was somebody that voted for him and not for me.
Oh, really?
Which means that somebody must have voted for me and not for him. Yeah, so thank you to whoever you are out there.
Yeah, you know, they always say that all the trends begin in California, and I have to say that $90 spending limit and the one-week campaign, that might be a pretty good idea. Maybe we could run with that.
Maybe scale it up a little bit, yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Julian Castro. When we come back, in just a minute. Almost every day, we hear something on the news about a cyber attack. Sometimes it's just a bunch of pranksters, but more often it's a foreign country with vast cyber resources trying to hack our power grid, our banking system, or our military's information networks. The National Security Agency plays a big part in protecting our country from cyber attacks, and you can help. The NSA is hiring technical professionals to serve on the front lines of information security. If you work in computer science, networking, programming, or electrical engineering, you can help keep your country safe. Design new hardware systems and networks, write faster, smarter programs, protect America's critical infrastructure, or help uncover what our adversaries are planning to do next. Learn more about careers at the National Security Agency today. Visit intelligencecareers.gov/NSA. That's intelligencecareers.gov/NSA. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! And now, back to the podcast. At what point did you and Joaquin start to forge your own separate paths, though?
I think little by little. You know, we'd grown up and shared a room together our whole lives and then had bunk beds when we were kids and teenagers. And then when we went away to college, even though we were there at Stanford, you know, we did not live in the same dorm. So we started to sort of have our own circle of friends and our own plans for the future. And by the time we got to law school, I think that continued. And then, you know, we still both became attorneys, and for a time, a short time, we were at the same law firm, but we decided to go different routes in public service, whereas local issues, municipal issues at the time really interested me, and that's what I wanted to work on. He wanted to tackle some of these bigger issues of education and infrastructure and healthcare. And so he went and ran for state representative, and he ended up serving 10 years as state representative in Texas.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. You were talking earlier about this impatience to get to the next step when you were in high school, and then in college, you know, you actually ran for San Antonio City Council when you were still in law school, and you ran in a district that skewed heavily toward a much older demographic. How did you get them to take this young kid seriously running for city council?
That is a good question. I was 26. And I went back home and graduated in 2000 from law school, went back home, took the bar, passed the bar. I was working at a firm, and there was an open city council seat in 2001. I had already started running for it. I knew that it was going to be open, and I was the youngest person to get elected at the time. Oddly enough, though, in that race, I think there was a guy that was 1 year younger than me, too, a 25-year-old.
Really?
But my main opponent did try and, at that time, tried to make something of my youth. I remember that he kind of copied my campaign sign format. It had my picture on it. But above his picture, he put experience. So he was trying to tell people, well, you know, this is the difference.
Yeah.
But hey, I've found that throughout politics, when you're running for office, people want to know that you're sincere, that you are who you say you are, mm-hmm. like you're genuine. And that you know what you're talking about. And I knew what I was talking about. And I had a strong vision for the future of that, those neighborhoods and of the city. And I was passionate about it. And so even if some folks at the time may have had reservations about somebody that was 26, and I probably looked like 20 or 22, you know, even younger than I was, they knew that I was serious, that I was informed, and that I was honest about what I wanted to do.
San Antonio city elections are nonpartisan, so you don't have to run as a Republican or a Democrat. Did you find that it was easier to get voters to give you a chance when you don't have a D or an R next to your name?
Oh, for sure. And I enjoyed that a lot. I enjoyed that you could walk up to any door and knock on the door and, you know, talk to folks about their streets, about the you know, jobs in the city, about the quality of the parks and the response times of fire and police. And you didn't get into questions that put people immediately into partisan camps. Mm-hmm. It allowed for folks to engage you based on what was important to them. And maybe even more importantly than that, it allowed the city council members to work across the aisle all the time, like regularly. Because you didn't feel the need to toe a party line. And, my brother had a very different experience. He was elected in 2002, started serving in January of 2003 in the first state legislature in more than 100 years that was then controlled by the Republicans, and was, you know, within a year or two, they were having a huge battle about redistricting. And my brother was part of a group that went over to Oklahoma to try and deny the Republican majority, a quorum. All of that was happening, and we were kind of leading these different political lives, but I enjoyed mine because I felt that it was more productive.
Mm-hmm. And in 2005, you ran for mayor of San Antonio, and your first time running for mayor was a little bit of a heartbreak for you because you were the odds-on favorite to win, only to eventually lose to a Phil Hardberger. What did that experience teach you?
Well, what it taught me was number one, that if you're serious about what you want in life, whether it's getting into public service or a job or whatever your goal is, that when you lose, when you don't get it, you have to make a decision about how much you want it and whether you're willing to work to get better in the pursuit of it. And that was the question for me after I lost. You know, would I come back? Would I stay in politics? Would I come back? There was time right after the election where I felt that maybe I would just get out of politics. But it's true what they say, that you win, you learn more when you lose than when you win. Mm-hmm. So I definitely, I learned that it's kind of a gut check when you lose like that.
Yeah.
The second thing that I learned is that, at the time that I needed to broaden my coalition of support a little bit. And I did that. in 2009.
Yeah, you ran 4 years later, and almost as soon as you were elected mayor, you began attracting national media attention. I guess that didn't really leave very much room for a young upstart politician to make a lot of mistakes. Did you feel that you were ready to be thrust in the national spotlight so soon?
Yeah, I did. I did by that time.
Yeah.
And it's not like you get into it and go from zero to – very few people go from zero to 100 in that regard. Like, you're completely thrown into it. You know, that happened over the course of probably about 2 years. There was an article that the New York Times Magazine ran in I think, May of 2010 that suggested that I had a bright future in politics. And then I was selected in the summer of 2012, announced that I would be giving – the keynote speech at the 2012 Democratic National Convention. And then, of course, that moment and the time after that, all the way up until my appointment by President Obama as HUD secretary. So that played out over the course of, you know, that first 2 years and then another 2 years. It didn't all happen at once. And I got used to it over time.
Yeah. And one of your signature programs that got you so much attention in 2010 was you created a program called SA 2020, which was this community-wide visioning effort, and it generated a whole list of goals based on what the people themselves were looking for in the city. That's one thing that I hear a lot of from well-run, technocratic cities all over the world. They give residents more of a forum to give feedback to local leaders. Do you think that cities and perhaps even states and the federal government need to be more creative and maybe give citizens opportunities to engage more with their government more frequently than just showing up to the polls every 2 to 4 years?
Oh, they absolutely should. And a lot of them do. You know, we have now with technology, especially unprecedented ways and multiple ways for citizens to give feedback, everything from, hey, there's a pothole over here on this street that is dangerous, that, you know, ought to be repaired immediately, to basically data essentially about when the best time to have swimming pools or libraries open is, or what streets are in need of the most repair. And then something like SA 2020, you know, this process basically was about bringing people together physically in the same room from different parts of town. We had, you know, over 1,000 people from all over the city in the first meeting, and then thinking through actual goals, concrete goals for the city. Yeah. So I'll give you an example. You know, we said we wanted to create at least 5,000 housing units in the downtown area and the urban core of our city. We said that we wanted to reduce traffic congestion by a certain amount, just all of these different specific goals that we had in different issue areas. And we gave ourselves a deadline of Friday, September 25th, 2020, which was exactly 10 years after the effort was launched. It gave people the sense that their voice counted and that we were actually driving towards something with a time frame. And this part is important for folks who do this, you know, for leaders who do this, with a time frame that was realistic, that was not too short, but also not too long,
right,
so that you could dig in and actually focus on getting these things done.
Yeah, and your biggest achievement as mayor was a program called Pre-K for SA. And when you set out to do this, you did something interesting. You enlisted the help of two of the most prominent businessmen in San Antonio to get support for a sales tax to fund the program. You don't hear a lot of stories like that. Do you think that Republicans and Democrats need to stop fueling this idea that government and private business are always at odds? I mean, sometimes collaboration between the private and the public sector can actually serve mutual interests.
Oh, absolutely. And I saw that, you know, twice in big ways. I mean, once was with Pre-K for SA, where the business community supported in a very significant way, taking a sales tax initiative to the voters to significantly expand high-quality full-day pre-K for four-year-olds in our city. And then the second time was at HUD, where we partnered with internet service providers to either provide for free or very, very discounted internet service to people living in public housing, because the vast majority of folks living in public housing don't have internet access. And we know that there's a homework gap that develops. There are other challenges. You know, how does somebody conveniently apply for a job or do other things that require internet access at home? It's not a luxury anymore. It's a necessity. And whether it was Google Fiber or Cox Communications or Charter or others, they stepped forward and engaged us on that. So I agree with you that that there are ways that the public sector and the private sector can work together. There are also ways that the public sector can work in the interest, especially of small business owners that make up 75% to 80% of the businesses out there. I don't know that we do that enough. I will say, you know, there are also, of course, real challenges with respect to our tax system and making sure that folks pay their fair share. And so I don't want to wave that off, but there are ways that we can work together as well.
Now, you mentioned your time as Secretary of HUD under President Obama. That must have been a big transition from an executive position like mayor to running a massive federal bureaucracy. How steep was that learning curve?
Yeah, it was a steep learning curve, and some parts of it more than others. You know, I was pretty familiar with some of the programs that HUD administers, especially the Community Development Block Grant Program and home funding and programs like that, and less familiar with the housing part of it. You know, I had basic knowledge, but really digging in and understanding that a lot better was the challenge of before I was nominated and then at the very beginning of my tenure. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed getting to work with so many career professionals that are dedicated to the mission of HUD and want to serve, you know, middle class and lower income Americans who are looking for housing opportunity. It was quite different from local government. The way I like to talk about it is that compared to the federal bureaucracy, trying to move things in that federal bureaucracy, a local government's like that easy button. Remember Staples used to have those commercials with the easy button? It was just a lot quicker and, you know, more straightforward to get something done at the local level versus getting it done at the federal level, where if you're a department, you're part of this ecosystem of politics and of bureaucracy, you know, that needs to all come together to make things happen. And sometimes it does, but even when it does, it takes a long time compared to local government.
Now, from what I understand, I think that you could have actually been a cabinet member earlier in the administration. I want to say that you were offered Secretary of Transportation, although I could be wrong. Why didn't you accept a position earlier in the administration?
Well, in very early 2013, President Obama called and suggested or asked if I was interested in serving in his administration. He did not specify what it was. I think others have said since then that it was likely Department of Transportation, but he never specified what it was. At the time, we had just passed pre-K for SA, and it hadn't been implemented yet. And San Antonio was doing very well. That was the role, you know, mayor of San Antonio that I looked forward to when I thought about getting into politics in the first place. And I just thought that it would be very weird if I were to leave right after we passed that and before it was even implemented. I wanted to make sure that it was successfully implemented and that, you know, we would do right by the folks who had just invested that much confidence in the program, in me, in the leadership at City Hall. So, you know, I basically said that I wanted to stay where I was at that time. He called again in April of 2014 about HUD. And at that time, I felt more ready to move on. And, you know, in addition to education as a passion, my other passion had been trying to revitalize our community and making investments in distressed neighborhoods. And San Antonio had been, you know, either the first or second most successful city in pursuing big HUD investments during my tenure and during the Obama administration. And so that part of it was kind of a natural fit.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I wonder if there was a certain amount of maturing that happened between, say, that moment and when you were dying to get out of high school into college a year earlier, when you were, you know, eager to get a post as a city councilman when you were in law school. It sounds like for the first time in your political career, you weren't eager to get on to the next step until you completed the step you were working on.
Yeah. No, it's a good way to think about it. And I think that that's true. And that probably does happen as we get older, right? Not to say I wasn't doing a good job in the other stuff, you know, along the way, because I think I was. But you get to a point where, okay, well, you love what you're doing and you're focused on it and you're making good progress. And so you don't necessarily feel, you know, that you just want to make a move to make a move. But a year and a half later, I felt that I could do that, and that whether it was pre-K for SA or other initiatives that we'd started at City Hall, that they would do well, you know, even if I weren't the mayor anymore.
Just a few years later, in 2016, you were on the short list for Hillary Clinton's running mate. How closely does that vetting process resemble a colonoscopy?
Oh, man, it's and I write, you know, in the book that the vice presidential selection process is one of the weirdest parts of American politics. Yeah. It's weird because if folks listening will think about it, most politics, there's the idea of the back room and all that, right? But most politics, if you're trying to win something, it's out there in the public. Mm-hmm. You're calling people, you're knocking on doors. There's a campaign that you outwardly have. The vice presidential selection process is traditionally, you know, if you're somebody that the campaign is interested in, you're not supposed to be interested in it outwardly.
Right.
In fact, you're supposed to deny that you're even, you know, under consideration for a long time. And there's this feverish amount of vetting that is happening in the background. I write about a little bit about that process. You know, the intensity of it lasted for about a month. It was longer than that overall, but the intense vetting lasted about a month. Did basically about 6 hours worth of interviews with a team of lawyers that had gone through everything from my finances to my public record to, you know, anything they could find, and had already produced two binders of information for the campaign on me and the other, like, you know, 9 or 10 people they were seriously considering. And then I had to go get a physical, which I hadn't done in a while. So that was a positive. That they just want to know that they want to know what they're dealing with each person.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting, fascinating process. I'm not sure that I would go through that again, because it's not like everyday politics. You're basically pitching to one person, and that's weird to me.
Yeah. Now, I saw that you spent some time in Iowa over the weekend, and that's not your first visit to one of these early primary states. How serious do you think you are about running in 2020?
I'm going to make a decision, a final decision about running for president after November.
Okay.
And I've been out to Iowa now a couple of times and been out to New Hampshire a couple of times. And, you know, it's very clear to me in both of those states and in the many other states that I've traveled to support candidates who are running in 2018, that people want change in this country. To me, it's not a question of whether people are going to vote for change. It's just a question of who's going to lead that change. And so I'm going to have a long conversation with my family. My wife, Erica, and I have a 9-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old boy. And then I'm going to keep getting a sense of what people are thinking while I travel through November 6th, and then we see what happens on November 6th, because I think that these elections set a mood, they set the tone for the next couple of years. And I'm not in a rush to make a decision. So I want to, you know, I want to get a sense of what the American people are telling us right now.
Well, regardless of whether you decide to run or not, from what you can tell, what do you think would be the playbook for beating Donald Trump in 2020?
I think the next president is going to have to articulate a strong, positive vision for the future. Somebody that helps to unite the country instead of divide it. Somebody that has integrity and is seen as honest compared to what we've seen over the last 18 months. And somebody that is seen as trying to expand opportunity for everybody instead of picking and choosing who gets opportunity and who doesn't based on what your religion is or what your background is or how much money your folks have or don't have. I think it's somebody that is the opposite of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I also believe that people are ready for a new generation of leadership. I hear that very clearly when I get out there. people want a new generation of leadership in this country. And Donald Trump, when he says that he wants to make America great again, well, I don't want this country to be anything again. I believe that we are in a great nation and that we need to make it even better in the future. So I'm convinced that the next president is going to be somebody that is leading us forward boldly, not leading us backward.
So you don't buy into this theory that in order to beat Donald Trump, Democrats need to find someone who's willing to get down in the gutter and have a street fight with him, like a Michael Avenatti or someone like that?
I believe that the Democratic nominee needs to be able to hold her own or his own, stand up for what they believe in, push back when you need to push back. But fundamentally, you need to have a positive vision for the future and be about optimism and hope, not about tearing people down. Yeah. You know, if you're spending all your time tearing people down, you're probably not going to beat Donald Trump at that game.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he does.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things to do is to study in other contexts, whether it's sports or it's business or politics, study why people that have a certain style of competing lose and what is able to vanquish them. And what you'll find is that when you have surprise upsets, generally it's not because somebody of the same style defeated that other person. It's a style that is different and is rooted in that person or that team's essence that takes them by surprise. You know, and I think, yeah, that's kind of maybe getting too philosophical about it, but I think that the next nominee and the next president is going to be somebody of a totally different style. It's not going to be the same thing as Donald Trump. It's going to be the opposite.
Yeah, yeah. Political fortunes generally turn on contrasts, I guess. Well, I wish you the very best with your next step, whatever that may be. Real quickly before we go, I just have to ask, can you and your twin brother, Joaquin, communicate telepathically?
We cannot. We don't have ESP, but we are very close. And so you can imagine that we oftentimes look at the world in very similar ways and think alike. So, but no ESP.
Okay. Well, one of these days I'll ask him that same question. One more time, the book is called An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. Julian Castro, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thanks again to Julian Castro for coming on the podcast. Order An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow Julian Castro on Twitter at Julian Castro. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream flavors. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.